Hello and welcome to the Hansen Hour podcast, where we spend an hour or thereabouts deep diving into the band Hansen. I'm your host, Megan, and you can join in with me and a special guest each week as we talk about a range of Hansen-related topics. I'm so excited that you are here to join in on this, so grab a cuppa or a glass of red and settle in for an hour of fun. It's guaranteed to make you smile. Hello and welcome to episode 5 of season 1 of the Hansen Hour. Today we have a really, really special treat. We have Casey, who is originally from New York, but at the moment she's in London, and you won't believe it, she was at the very first Paremus? Wait, how do you say it? Can you say it for me? Paremus?
Very close. Paramus Park Mall.
Paramus Park Mall. We were practicing before this went live. I was trying to get my Jersey sort of American thing. Paramus Park Mall.
We'll get there.
Which we all know from Tulsa, Tokyo, in the middle of nowhere. So this is going to be really, really awesome. We're going to break it down a little bit for you, and we're also going to talk about, we're up to Where's the Love. So we're going to talk about that. So anyway, hello, Casey. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
And this is going to be so great. So I just want to start off by asking you, have you got a favorite Hansen show to date? And favorite Hansen song.
Wow, Megan, you're coming out of the gate swinging with the tough questions here. Okay. Well, I've been a Hansen fan since 1997. And in those, 26 years, I definitely don't take it for granted that I've seen many live shows, like big ones, small ones, super intimate gigs. But I'd have to say, most recently, when they toured Europe for RGB, I had actually won a meet and greet for Gothenburg.
Great.
And I thought the energy during that show was actually next level. So, it was early in the tour. I think that was their first trip, to Sweden at that time, generally. And just the reciprocated energy from the crowd was like so, palpable. There was this moment where I Will Come to You came on, and the whole crowd was just emotional and like in tears. It was like, it was absolutely next level. Yeah. There was also, there was this moment during my meet and greet where, I think I was speaking to Zach, and I said, I'm going to be at a bunch of shows. I'm going to be at London and New York, whatever, making just nonsense chit chat. So then, fast forward, the concert ends, and, we're doing our Hansen thing, waiting by the tour bus in hopes they'll come out. Finally, like, Isaac and Zach came out, and, like, with my adrenaline and my energy, I was like, when Zach got to me, I was like, Zach, I think that was the best show I've ever seen of you guys live. And he was like, well, you'll have to report back to me after the New York show. And I was like, oh, he remembered from my meet and greet. Like, R.I.P. me. I peaked then. That was it.
Good. Yeah. And the New York show, it didn't quite stack up.
Well, yeah, it did. Listen, I'm not going to complain about a show of theirs, but yeah. I just happen to think Gothenburg was like really, really amazing.
Yeah. Actually, I feel like I heard people talking in the forum about that show. I think that it was quite a special one.
Yeah, there's something about the energy, and the fans were truly like just the sweetest kind of fans I've really ever met. So,
That's nice to hear. And could you, or are you willing to narrow down a favorite song?
Oh, willing to. All right. Well, I do think about this, and my last name is Penny. And my friends call me Penny sometimes, and in Penny and Me, there's a lyric about New York in there. So if I had to be super choosy, I'd probably say Penny and Me.
That's cute. I like it.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm really excited to be talking to someone who was actually at
Say with me, say with me. Paramus.
Paramus,
There we
pardon.
go.
It is really for me as a kid watching Tulsa Turk in the middle of nowhere on repeat. This scene is one that was on rewind. It really stood out to me. It was wild and I loved it. And you could feel the energy from that through the VHS. It was really cool. So I'm really excited to be talking about it. What's some of your memories? Like, what can you remember? What can you share from being there?
I think it's really unlocked a lot of like these personal kind of brain Easter eggs thinking back on this time. I think, one word to describe it, like pandemonium. I mean, it was actually insane. Paramus is about an hour, no, like an hour and a half from where I live in Brooklyn. We didn't drive then, right? We were quite young, so we relied on our parents to chauffeur us around. That effectively became like, our personal Uber drivers around that time, like schlepping us hundreds of miles to various shows. So Paramus, I think we left like early afternoon-ish to try to get there and get a good spot, but we had no idea what we were about to kind of happen upon. And I'd say like, I faintly remember bumper to bumper parking lot traffic, right? Like there was no flow. It was like quite chaotic. I think there are estimates that there were like, what, 6,000 to up to 8,000 people, packed in there, packed in and around the center of this mall. And then there was this teeny tiny little stage. It wasn't even a stage. It was like risers, like one of those things if you sneeze too hard, you're gonna like blow it down kind of thing. I could kind of almost like not really, but I just have this audio memory of like the Doc Martin boots kind of stepping on it. It was kind of hollow, but like very like flimsy. I think they played like three total songs. It was acoustic. At that point, they didn't have a concert to perform, and then that's it. They were out of there. So quick.
It's so interesting to me, and that's the thing, and that's why I love, for a lot of my own research and my own exploration, and I'd like to think that other people have the same sort of trails of thoughts as me. Just trying to wrap my head around sort of the series of events that led to that amount of people showing up, and because I talked to, oh, I can't think of what guest it was, but we were talking about at that time exactly what you're saying. So much of it was promo, right? We're not doing these sort of live concerts, and you're right, because there wasn't really a concert to do at that point. But so is it really like thinking about the CD release, right? So it was the day before the promo concert, May 7th, I think Milo Nowhere came out. So how is that big of a crowd showing up back then without social media? Is it just off radio play? Like, do you remember how it is that you got to that point to be there that day with all those other people? Like, how did we know about them to show up if the CD wasn't even released or had just been released? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's incredible, isn't it? And I have some theories about this. I think it's been spoken about to some extent before, but like starting in, 1996, but like hitting an apex in 1997, like all the major broadcast networks and the radio stations in the US were making this really big kind of music format and genre shift and pivot. So, like in the years leading up to that, the airwaves were kind of dominated by grunge and alternative rock, and it was so pervasive. But like, there was this like, the climate was like ready for this shift, for pop music and fun and feel good music. In 1997, the Spice Girls were launched in the U.S. and Wannabe like became number one right away. The Backstreet Boys released their first US album. It was like very ripe for that type of sound and vibe and energy. And if you were the type of band or musical artist that fit into that, there was big promo dollars behind that, going into that. And I think, the other driving factor definitely would have been obviously MTV. You know, in 1997, MTV in the States was in the tens of millions of households. And at that time, there was like, Hanson really fit into this like sweet spot demographic, obviously. Like, advertisers love the 12 to 24 year olds. So, like, Hanson was just like perfect for that. So, I remember M-Bop, when it came out, was on repeat. Or if it wasn't on repeat, we were like recording it and watching it on repeat on VHS. So, like, it was just like the right moment, right time, really, I think.
Yes. So, did the film clip, I have to do more research, the film clips come out as a single before the album, do we think? Maybe that too, if we're thinking about sort of seeing it, because we obviously knew what they looked like as well, which was one of the reasons we're all showing up. So there must have been,
I think that video, it was like, burned in my brain, it was like, I mean, at that time, MTV still was, they were shifting out of music videos probably a little bit after that, but at that time, it was still, that was what you came for. So I just remember it, those guys walking down the street in front of the yellow house, like that is just like etched in my brain forever. And the we were young with hormones. Come on. What's not to like,
There's nothing better than that film clip. And you would see it come on and you'd be like, oh my God, oh my God. It's like them walking down the street and that those first couple of notes and you just think, oh, this is it. So I'm just looking up, when it was released. So yeah, it was released on April 15, 1997, and then
there would have been 2 weeks difference, or maybe 3 weeks.
Yeah, God, it's just, and I know I talk about it a lot. It is really like a cognitive jump to try and wrap my head around how, and I know that it didn't happen quickly because we know that there was that lead up and they were playing shows and there was a lot sort of going on. But obviously they must have had big dollars invested in them, like what you were saying, for that promo to be done so heavily. There was a belief that they were going to, this was going to work out, and it did, obviously. Anyway.
Yeah, and the external factors from the industry at large helped propel it, right? It really was, I think, right moment, right time, because there was such an interest to shift kind of the needle in the genre.
So I love
I think, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. So I heard, too, that they shut them all down from, like, you couldn't just go there just to shop because of the amount of people. Do you remember anything about it being shut down, or
No, that's really jogging my memory. I would have to imagine, once we were in, it was a mob. It was a bunch of bodies everywhere. So I don't know what was going on the outside, but you would imagine they probably had to restrict entry because it would have been like a hazard, a safety hazard.
Yeah. And one of I put it on my Instagram. One of my favorite scenes is when Taylor's like, and the guy goes, "Do you know who these guys are?" And we were just kind of like, "No, don't." And the swell of scream coming up. Do you remember the pitch of the scream? Do you remember, like, where are you in relation to this little cardboard stage?
Like, I have to say, a lot of parts of the memory are a bit fuzzy. I've had to piece it together, but do I vividly remember the shrills and like the decibel levels and like the ear, it was like eardrum bursting levels, right? But I also remember that it did not bother me in the slightest, right? Like, to be young again, I was screaming on top of my lungs as well. We weren't, my friends, so I went with four friends who we had become like, Hanson fans from day dot. We stuck together. So I was with four of them. I just remember we were, I think, on the ground level. We're not so close to the front, but, close enough considering just the sheer scale of the event. So it was really like not easy to see for sure because we're all kind of flat. If you weren't like stacked up on the floors, there was really no kind of like stack level anything. You were just on a flat ground with this tiny little riser, so it was actually kind of hard to see.
Yeah, I remember I've spoken about it before, going to here in Australia in that same sort of vein on Tulsa, Tokyo, Milano, where we had the similar thing happen at Southland here, so in Melbourne, but they ended up moving it outside of the, well, we call them shopping centres here, like out of the side of the mall, and they put it in the car park. And I remember, yeah, the devastation of it. They clicked onto it pretty quickly, so they put barriers up, and we were sort of put into sections, you know, so like cattle, like a section here, and then there was like a little break, and then the next section back, and back and back and back again. And I remember showing up, and yeah, you just, I couldn't got, but oh God, I want to go back. I just want to be in that moment and feel it and actually see them. Nothing compares. I mean, I love them now and I love the shows and I still get it, but you that the buzz that you got from the 97 era, what we're doing now, the middle of nowhere era versus today, when you sort of grow up a little bit, it's just, it's not the same, but it's great, but it's not the same, right? Like,
I think it's the hormones, right? I think we have them under control now, but at the time they were really amping it up. I still feel that like energy and passion though. And, you know, I wasn't an expert concert goer then, like I consider myself now. So like, you know, positioning didn't actually, it wasn't that consequential to me at that time, just because I didn't know what to expect. But I very quickly learned, you know, be strategic about your timing, your positioning. You know?
If you're serious, you know, if you don't want to be back there. And I had my guests on last week. I don't know if you heard that, but they talked a lot about, not a lot, but we brought up that sort of pack mentality of once, in terms of that screaming, even if you're a very like grounded person, when you're in that situation, you do tend to, if the person next to you is starting to go wild and screaming, it's sort of like it's science.
It's contagious.
You start, and that, no doubt, like that's what would have brought that crowd up.
I think I'm the one that starts it now, you know, because I can't sit still. Like when I go to a Hanson concert in this, you know, my old age, I can't stand still, you know, and it just kind of, I could see it. Yeah. Maybe some people are annoyed by it, but others kind of join in and I can see, you know, the contagion.
Yes. Well, that's it. That's it.
That's too funny.
So we, let me sort of come back to, back to Tulsa, Tokyo in the middle of nowhere, and where Taylor gets his shirt ripped, right? And being a kid, I remember just being like, wow, like I can't, like this is so full on, like they actually ripped his shirt trying to grab him. Do you remember, like, and you are a little bit far away, but in terms of the exit, was it for you more orderly, not being down in that sort of front bit where everyone's trying to grab them as they go off? Do you remember seeing them walking off or anything?
Well, I remember a lot of commotion. Like the commotion was everywhere, you know, but obviously it was very highly concentrated in the exit way, right? It was obviously insanely hard to see the detail because the mob of bodies, but I do have this really like fuzzy memory of this big burly dude, like almost having to like intercept Zach most likely, and like, you know, almost physically pick him up off the ground and shuffle him out because there's just hands and like mania. And mind you, like there wasn't loads of space between the rafters and the egress. Like it wasn't that big of a space, you know? So it was just like the push of the mob went forward, and it happened so quickly, but also so slowly at the same time. And yeah. I remember my friends and I were thinking, like, you know, of course we'd want to try to beat the guys outside, but, you know, we were no dummies. Like, that wasn't even going to be remotely realistic in this, like, melee that was ensuing. Mm-hmm. So it was just, it was wild. It really was wild.
Yeah, straight in the car and out of there.
Yeah.
So I've thrown this in because, like, I have been rewatching Tulsa, Tokyo in the middle of nowhere for research, right? That's what I'll say. And one of the bits that I really like is at there's a part in it where Isaac and Taylor are standing together, and it looks like what I would call in Australia a quarry. So it's a body of water, and they actually, you see them jump off the top of a huge rock, and they're drinking soft drink, and Isaac turns Taylor around to the camera and says, I mean, look at what you did to him. You ripped his shirt, or something like this, like, you animals, or something like that. So obviously they've bailed out, and I never realized this until I'm starting to put the two and two together. They've bailed out of the mall and gone down to some sort of river or anything. Does that sound familiar to you? Like, I know you're not from Jersey, so that might throw a little bit of a spanner in the works, but if anyone listening is from Jersey, where is this place? Because I'm gonna go.
Right? You know, yeah, like you say, I'm not a native New Jersey girl, but it sounds like it could be a possible job for those investigative Hansen historians out there, or like, you know, Google Earth it, you know, we could do like a little virtual tour for us, but I actually have no idea. I'm a bad American, you know, I'll put my hand up, I have no idea what that is.
I love it because I like put together a narrative in my head, like disgustingly, that like they're in the car and they've driven off and they've gone to let off steam and blow off steam like young boys do, and being such in a crazy atmosphere, and they're drinking soda and they're jumping off these things and they're all wet. It looks like they've just pulled over and like gone out and just, yeah, let off all this steam from it. So I'm super interested. So if anyone does know, leave us a comment.
And I actually, that's a really great point you make. And it's something I've definitely, you know, as I watch Tokyo in the middle of nowhere back, I'm actually very impressed by the fact that you could tell that the Hansen family and entourage, like, they really let the kids have time to be kids at that age, you know?
Yeah.
You see that they take the time out to go to, like, what was it, Sega World or Mega World, like, things like that. Like, just making sure, you know, the kids could be kids, which you don't often hear about in the entertainment industry. That's why, like, a lot of these celebrities kind of, you know, just go off a beaten path because they just had to grow up too quickly. But you just don't get that sense with these guys. And that's a great example, I think.
I think so. And I think that I, again, with my false narratives, really also think that they do a lot of that now for their own families. So I don't think, I believe that that's why they play SeaWorld and that's why they play Epcot and Disney and things like that. And a lot of their touring really does think, like, you know, if we're bringing the kids, or how can we make it fun for the kids as well? So I think that that's probably something that was really instilled in them.
Yeah.
Like, rock and roll, but make it fun. Like, you know.
I love that. Rock and roll, but make it fun.
I'm sure it'd be pretty fun regardless.
Yeah, I know. I don't know how hard that would be of a task.
So, again, you're not native Jersey, but why are we playing Paramus Park Mall? Of all
nailed it. You nailed the pronunciation, firstly.
What, like, why? Why are they there at that place, of all places? Like, do you think?
Well,
theory.
I have to imagine that was probably a decision that was made by Z100, who organized the promo for the event. So from a proximity perspective, like, Paramus is close-ish to the Z100 headquarters. So I think logistically, it probably made a bit of sense. But also, Paramus actually was one of the bigger malls in the States at that time.
Oh,
and and it actually does have a little bit of a history of, like, a stopover as, you know, on the music mall tours. So I think I read once that, like, Tiffany started her mall tour there. So, like, you know, I think we're alone now. Like, that was the first stop on her mall tour. So, like, hey, you know, she's one of the greats. So just seems
that's
apropos
awesome.
They start there. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Thank you for sharing that, because for, especially, you know, as an Australian, it can be a little bit tricky to try and put that together. So that makes a lot of sense.
This is pure conjecture, but, you know, and I personally wasn't a Paramus Paul aficionado, but those reasons kind of make sense, I think.
Yeah. Because I don't think, You know, I think when we're looking at the promo stuff, and I should pull up Katie's Hanson Stage website, but going through that sort of 97 era, when they were doing promo, I don't think a lot of it was malls, right? Like, I feel like that could have been the, oh, and I'm sure people are just going crazy, like, yes, they did, they played. Do you know what I mean? But I don't know. I feel like it was just a weird, like a, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, that's when I'd have to fact check, like you. I don't really know the intricacies. You know, I'm sorry, fans, if I've, you know, misstated anything. But yeah, it's a good question.
We're trying and
don't
we're.
Don't skewer us.
Yeah. We're here, and I want to learn, so yeah. All right, so should we jump into Where's the Love?
Absolutely.
Awesome. So I actually love this song. I love hearing it live. I love that the crowd still to this day does the little round and round twirl. I love it. And the clip was done by Tamara Davis, who did Mbop as well, which it still has that sort of youthful, vibey thing to it. And Mark Hudson co-wrote this with the band, and we still all know Mark Hudson now. And this is one I've just been thinking about too lately that I'm just going to throw in there. For me, listening to Where's the Love now, there's a lot of awesome components in that song that I think are such classic Hanson sort of stylings. One, and we don't hear him enough anymore. We still hear a couple of, like, Isaac guitar solos. But back then, especially in Middle of Nowhere, they did an Isaac guitar solo on almost so many songs. But then each brother would have their own little line to sing, right? They shared the singing a lot more, where now we're sort of having the one lead, right? And the thing that I love about when they do that live, especially when we were younger and maybe now, but it gave you the opportunity, like if you were a Zach girl and like when his line came on, you'd be like, woo! And then, like, you know, when Isaac had his turn, or when Isaac comes out and does his little solo, you would just go wild, you know? We don't see that enough now, a little bit, but not like we did on Middle of Nowhere. And that's why this song has all those things that I love about the Hanson, like, songwriting back in those days. So what do you think about this song? One of your faves as well, or?
So this part of the interview might get a bit contentious because it's not up there as one of my faves, but yes. Wait, no, let me add some caveats. So actually, I love your perspective because, you know, it's not innately one of my favorite songs. So I hadn't really considered that those elements of it. But actually, You're right. I'm sure in the moment back in 87, I probably did love that. You know, Taylor had that pubescent, like, iconic scratchy vocal at that time that, like, still really stands out. And it really got center stage when they sang that. You know, I think probably one of the coolest parts about being a Hanson fan still to this day is, like, rediscovering things about their history that I now find interesting that I didn't back then. So, like, going back to Mark Hudson and Tamara Davis, like, that is, like, ridiculous talent and star power to have on that track. You know, like, you know, back then I would have been like, oh, Mark Hudson, what is that, like, related? Is he related to Kate Hudson? And that would have been the extent of it. But actually, like, he is, like, a crazy force. And the same with Tamara Davis, right? So, like, that's pretty amazing that they had them on there. I think Tamara Davis, she was married to a Beastie Boy as well, like, so she's got, like, instant street cred with me. Yeah. They're from Brooklyn. Yeah. For me, actually, like, you know, is Where's Love my favorite track of all time? No. But do I make that silly round and round gesture when I see them live? Like, absolutely, yes. For me, though, it's more about the music video that's really such a central part of my memory. I just think there's so many things about it. You know, the color palette, like, it was so bright, the fast-paced cuts and camera angles, the way the guys interacted with the camera. You know, they had, like, semi-choreo and, like, hand gestures, which, obviously, that's where a little twirl got inspired from. You know, now that I live in London, it's got all this iconic London backdrop, you know, which I now appreciate. And, of course, we remiss not to mention the 90s fashion. I mean, that was just, like, you know, such a time capsule of the 90s. You know, and don't get me wrong, like, I think the lyrics, they still hold meaning. When that drum fill, you know, comes on at the concert, like, it's instantly recognizable. But despite the fact that I'm, like, kind of raving about this song right now, it's actually not one of my favorite tracks.
Yeah, I totally understand what you're saying. Now, it's not one of my favorites. I love it for the nostalgia factor.
Yeah.
For all those things that you said. 100% all those things that you said. And it just, especially re-listening to it now, I do, you know, have a different sort of relationship with it. But, you know, coming back to what you were saying about the star power behind it, researching Middle of Nowhere and seeing, you know, who co-wrote what musicians they brought in to do this, that star power that you talk about comes back again to how much went into them and promoting it and the belief to make it work, because it's actually crazy, all the engineers, all the people that worked on it. This was big. It wasn't just some, you know, run-of-the-mill thing. There was a lot that went into it, which I, again, you know, I'm not surprised about, but I think it comes with maturity as well to look back and be like, oh, wow, right, that were really going for it.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm just imagine, you know, when the Dust Brothers kind of abandoned the project in their, you know, the early stages, like, just the financial hit that would have taken, you know, to, like, scramble and find new talent. So there's just so many different components at that time that I wouldn't have even thought about at that, you know, when I was in 1997. Like, none of that was in my, you know, realm of thinking whatsoever. But now that I'm back, and sometimes, you know, hearing podcasts and interviews from people that, you know, took part at the time as musicians and producers, like, I'm just, you know, it's really unbelievable. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think often as fans, we say the guys don't get enough credit for some of that stuff. And I still, you know, when I unfold more layers of the onion about who was involved and all that went into it, like, I say that with a lot of affirmation, you know?
I totally agree. Yeah, I know. It's so weird. So the film clip, the iconic film clip that you're talking about, I 100% understand what you're saying. Oh my God, it was so good. I watched it back the other day and, like, oh my God, it's my favorite. I was laughing, like, when Taylor is watching, like, these two, like, a couple having a little mini argument in the mall, and his face.
The facial expressions on all of them. Isaac has some gems as well.
They're really serious about it. Like, and then, anyway, I love that. But coming back, like, why do you think that we're in London filming this clip? Like, I can't wrap my head around that either, because, you know, location-wise, does it... Oh, I just had a thing. I wonder if she was there for work or something.
I mean, who's to say, you know, what was happening in the background? But I do know, I believe, like, Stephen Leroney was a UK-based producer, I think.
Right. Okay.
They might have flown him over to the States or whatever, but he's from the UK. So I'd say there's, you know, that's probably maybe an element of it. Obviously, again, pure conjecture. But also, they did spend early months of the promo in Europe. So maybe just with timings and the way the promo schedule worked out, perhaps, you know, there was some overlap that made sense, you know?
Yeah, some really good points.
We've got to get someone in here to, like, you know, tell us what the truth is.
Well, I've reached out to Tamara that many times. Oh, multiple. If they've had anything to do with the album, I'm on it. And I think everyone is so sick of me by now, but that's fine. Like, I'll just keep going. Because, you know, I think that it is really important to get – we've never really got, like, those official sort of accounts of things. And I think it's about time that we really start piecing it all together.
It's long overdue. Do you remember Pop-Up Video on MTV?
No,
or was it
VH1? We never had that. And that's the thing. Like, we feel very, like, let down. But we just never had them.
Hanson, if you ever listen to this podcast, and I know you will one day, we demand, the people demand a revamped pop-up video that you host, and you tell us all the little tips and tricks about the video and the little secrets that we don't know.
We're asking for it. And pop-up video is something where they would come on and, like, talk about it? Is that right?
Well, sort of. So they would play the video, and then there are these literal little bubbles that would pop up with little factoids about scenes that were happening in the video. And sometimes you'd have quotes, and sometimes you'd have, like, talking heads that would, like, intersperse and, you know, share some context. But, like, it was super fun to watch, you know? So if they could host something like that or just contribute to it, I'd definitely watch it.
Yes, absolutely, and we'll keep campaigning for Tamra to come on and have a chat too, because it was only the two, and then we move on to a couple of other producers. But I'd really like to get Tamra. All right, so this again, I'm getting my head around some things here. So in terms of it being a single, right? So. It never got on the official US Billboard chart because at the time there were rules that said a song had to have a commercial release. So a commercial release, for those that don't know, is when you officially release a song as a single. So in Australia, in the UK, and a couple of other countries, it was released as a single, but in the US it was only used as a promo. For what? I mean, I don't know, like... only because I had Alyssa on, and I remember her saying that maybe Weird, it was a similar situation with Weird, and that song was used more for promo, but for, I don't know, advertising or something, I don't know. And so the reason they were saying it was only used for promo, you could only hear like the full song by buying the album, and then that drove up album sales. If that makes sense. So there were more going for album sales over single sales. So thinking that people in the US would buy the full album. So I don't know what do you think was going on? What do you think's going on?
Yeah, you're right. Where's the Love didn't go to retail as a single in the States. Mm. But, you know, that said, I did have plenty of non-Hanson fan friends who recognized the track. You know, it did get steady enough airplay on the radio waves, and, you know, the video definitely was a staple on MTV. You know, I think the marketing mechanics around that time to, you know, give an album some, you know, real airtime were so different, obviously, today. You also have to remember, I think, you know, Where's the Love came out around, I want to say September-ish in 1997. Mm-hmm. Middle of Nowhere was already out for, like, what, half a year at that point? But also, you're coupling this with, like, just generally a major, major year for pop music in the U.S., like I was talking about earlier. You know, and from what I do understand, Hanson was one of the biggest, if not the biggest, like, commercial signings for their label that year. But you'd have to imagine it was such a whirlwind, like, year on so many levels with promo on Mbop alone and the travel and everything. So I think with the gift of hindsight now, I personally think it was the right call not to push it as a commercial single, just with all the other major, like, macro music industry things happening. Because I don't know that Where's the Love would have had the retail, like, buoyancy, you know, if it was on its own. But again, that's just a point of view.
I hear what you're saying, and I suppose that's that point of difference, because here in Australia I've mentioned that we didn't have MTV or whatever, like TRL that you guys talk about, or VH1, and I suppose we didn't have that saturation of getting to see artists on the scale that you did. So here when it was released, it went to number two, it was huge, but we probably were fed a smaller amount of artists than you guys were. Like you really had that sort of breadth. So that could be, yeah, you've got such excellent points.
Such a resurgence of, like, the shift in the genre. Then all these artists were being spoon-fed to us. And it was like, whoa, a boy band. Whoa, girl band. Mm-hmm. Whoa, these guys that write their own music. Like, just, like, oh, probably oversaturation, I think, was a great word to use. So, yeah, I don't know. And there's, like, the
MTV Music Awards. I mean, MTV was just like, you know, a force here. So there were so many promos around that. And I think the guys were on SNL this year. Like, they were busy. They didn't need it to hit retail. They had plenty of other opportunities going on.
Yeah.
Well, good for Australia for getting it to the top of the charts. Well done.
I know. I think, and you know what? I am so glad we've had this chat because I haven't always been able to piece it together. And that just makes a lot more sense to me now. Like, because here, everything that they released really went in at least to the top five really quickly. Like, it was wild. And in the US, they never had that. They didn't always reach that level on the charts, or if they released it at all. And I was like, that's weird. Like, why? Like, what's going on there? But yeah, you're so right. Like, oh, look at you.
you guys made the music work harder. I love that. You know, there's definitely different elements to, you know, positives to both, I would say.
Yeah, and I suppose the world was somewhat smaller then, and even in terms of touring and marketing and things like that, you would probably have different budget resources than what you do now. Like, getting to Australia to do a tour is probably a much more easier thing to do now than it was back in 97, and all of those sorts of things. So it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think so. I think they were competing with a lot at that time in the States. So I would imagine even getting Mbop the airtime would have been, you know, quite the feat, which they succeeded on, right? But maybe they depleted the budget by then. I don't know.
Yeah. That's another good thing too. Well, Casey, I think we'll wrap it up. We could talk all night, day where you are, night where I am. But yeah, this has been such a treat for me, and you've really opened up my eyes on a lot of different things that I, you know, was grappling with to get my head around. So I'm sure everyone else feels the same. It's a really interesting chat. So thank you so much.
Oh, Megan, thank you for having me. I've loved it. It was so fun. And I love the pod. So I can't wait to hear what's coming next.
Oh, I know. I got a good one. I'm recording again this week. So, but I'll keep it secret.
Oh, boo.
I know. I'll tell you as soon as I press stop. Okay. All right. I'll see you soon. Bye.
Thanks, Megan. Bye.